Picture a windowless room in 1996. We are in the back office of a major U.S. bank.
Right, the heart of the financial system.
Exactly. And all around you are mountains of paper checks. I mean, thousands upon thousands of them stacked in these plastic trays. You can hear the relentless, slow grind of human clerks with tired eyes manually typing handwritten amounts into mechanical keyboards, just one check at a time.
It was an incredibly tedious, error-prone, exhausting process.
It really was. And yet, sitting quietly in the corner is a machine that is silently taking over half of that massive pile without anyone really noticing. Today, we are taking a deep dive into the source material, specifically focusing on the book Jan LeCun, Father of Artificial Intelligence. And we are looking right at Chapter 4, The Neural Network That Read American Checks.
It is a remarkable moment in history to explore for you today because, well, to understand the technology surrounding you right now, you really have to understand how these early neural networks survived what was known as the AI winter.
Right, the period when funding just dried up.
Exactly. And they survived by hiding in bank vaults. They proved their worth in the relentless, unforgiving market of finance, all while mainstream academia had completely turned its back on them.
So our mission for you today is to explore this incredible underground journey. We are going to unpack the counterintuitive math of making an artificial brain smarter by, well, literally damaging it.
Which sounds completely backward, I know.
Right. And we will see how these largely ignored experiments from the 1990s built the exact mathematical foundation for the modern artificial intelligence world you live in right now.
So to understand how that silent machine ended up in a bank, we really have to start in the laboratory. Before this architecture could reliably read chaotic financial documents, it had to be radically optimized.
Because they had hit a wall, right?
A massive one. Researchers at Bell Labs in Holmdel, New Jersey, had run into this massive computational bottleneck in the late 1980s. They had successfully built Linet 1, which was an early model that could read well-formatted handwritten zip codes.
Okay, zip codes seem simple enough.
They are, but that initial success immediately revealed a new daunting wall. If they wanted the neural network to solve a harder, more complex problem, they had to make the network bigger.
Meaning they had to add more layers and more parameters.
Exactly. But as the network grew, two devastating things happened. First, the learning time just exploded. I mean, a single workstation would grind away day and night just to train a few thousand weights.
Wow, just days of waiting.
Yeah, and second, and honestly much more dangerously, the network suffered from overfitting.
Ah, overfitting. This is a huge concept for our listeners.
It was the absolute plague of early machine learning. When a network becomes too large, it stops learning the universal concept of a number.
It just memorizes things instead.
Right. It memorizes the exact tremble of the pen, the specific ink bleed, and the exact pixel location of a 7 written by one particular person.
So it's not learning what a 7 is, it's learning that specific drawing of a 7.
Exactly. If you hand that overfitted network a brand new 7 written by someone else, it completely fails. It swallows the training examples whole instead of extracting the structural skeleton of the data.
I always think of overfitting like a student who memorizes every single answer on a practice test, right down to the typos.
That's a great way to look at it.
But then they completely fail the real exam because they never actually learned the underlying principles of the subject.
That is the exact dynamic. So researchers were stuck in this frustrating loop of manual labor. They were basically just guessing how big a network should be, you know, adding a layer, seeing if it memorized too much, taking a layer away.
Just trial and error.
Endless trial and error. That was the status quo until a team consisting of Jan LeCun, John S. Denker, who was a physicist, and Sarah A. Sola, an information theorist, published a paper in 1989. And the paper carried this incredibly provocative title, Optimal Brain Damage.
Optimal brain damage. I mean, that sounds like a horrific concept for people who spent their entire careers trying to grow artificial brains.
It really does.
Why would you intentionally damage the network you just spent days building?
Because they realized that the only way to force the machine to generalize was to restrict its capacity. They basically wanted to put a fully grown neural network on a surgical table and carefully cut out the useless connections.
Okay, but the fundamental mathematical problem there is figuring out which connections are actually useless.
Precisely. Because before this, the standard practice was pretty naive. People would just look at the numerical weights of the connections, and if the absolute value of a weight was small, say close to zero, they just deleted it.
But deleting a connection just because its numerical value is small seems incredibly short-sighted. Isn't that like knocking out a small wooden beam in a house just because it's thin, without checking if it's the load-bearing beam holding up the roof?
That is the perfect analogy. Mm-hmm. And Lacan's team suspected exactly that. A small weight might be structurally vital to the network's reasoning, while a massive weight might just be an echoing redundancy doing nothing at all.
So how did they find the load-bearing beams?
They realized they needed a true measure of importance, a concept they called saliency. Saliency isn't about the size of the number. It is about how much the entire network's error rate would spike if you severed that specific connection.
And here is where their backgrounds in physics and information theory totally changed the game for this deep dive. They didn't just guess, right?
No, not at all. They looked at the error landscape of the neural network as if it were a physical, multidimensional valley.
A physical valley. Okay, walk us through that.
Well, training a network is essentially a journey down into an error valley. As the machine learns and corrects its mistakes, it descends. When learning is finished, the network has reached the flat bottom of this valley where the error is as low as it can go.
Makes sense.
But at that exact bottom, the slope, what mathematicians call the first derivative, is virtually zero. It is completely flat.
So the slope tells you absolutely nothing about what to cut.
Exactly. So they didn't stop at the first derivative. They looked at the second derivative, which measures curvature.
Curvature. Okay, why is curvature the secret?
Because the second derivative tells you how steeply the walls of the valley curve upwards from that flat bottom in any given direction. Imagine you were standing at the bottom of a canyon.
Okay, I'm picturing it.
If you take a step to the north, you might immediately hit a sheer vertical cliff face. That steep curvature means if you change a network connection along that axis even slightly, the error rate will skyrocket.
Ah, so that connection is a load-bearing beam. It is vital.
Exactly. But if you look to the east, the canyon floor might remain flat and gentle for miles. You can push the weight in that direction all the way to zero, effectively deleting it, and the error barely changes.
That is brilliant. By mapping this mathematical curvature, they could calculate the exact saliency of every single connection without having to manually delete and test each one.
And the result of this mathematical surgery was stunning. By following this topographical map of the curvature, they successfully cut out roughly 75% of the network's connections.
Wow, 75%. They reduced it to a quarter of its original size.
They did. And paradoxically, it didn't get worse. It got significantly better.
It became far more accurate on data it had never seen before.
Yes. By stripping away all those useless, redundant connections, they removed the noise. The network simply did not have the storage capacity to memorize the exact pen strokes anymore. It was forced to actually learn the underlying geometric patterns of the numbers.
You know, I can't help but marvel at the biological parallel here. Human babies are born with an absolute overabundance of neural connections in their brains.
Oh, that's a very good point.
Right. And as they grow and learn about their environment, the brain physically prunes away the unused synapses. It actually cuts away connections to make the mind sharper and more efficient.
And Lacan's team was doing the exact same thing to an artificial mind. They were proving that sometimes throwing information away is the only way to find the truth.
And that principle of restraint, of knowing exactly what information to discard, becomes the defining philosophy for everything that follows in our source text today.
It really does. Shrinking the network wasn't just a neat academic trick to save computer memory. It gave them the mathematical efficiency required to scale up to much larger, much more complex challenges.
So they've mathematically shrunk this artificial brain down to its most essential parts. But being small and efficient doesn't mean anything unless you actually have a real-world problem to test it on.
And right around this time, in the mid-1990s, the field of handwriting recognition got the ultimate standardized test. It was called the MNIST dataset.
That was a massive collection of handwritten digits, right?
Yeah, from high school students and census workers. Suddenly, everyone in the field had the exact same test to benchmark their networks against.
But Lynette 1, their early model, was simply too small to absorb all that varied, chaotic data.
So Lacan systematically evolved the architecture. He added more convolutional layers and more summarizing layers until he arrived at the masterpiece, Lynette 5, which was finalized in 1998. This network ballooned to roughly 60,000 parameters.
We really have to ground this in the reality of the hardware of the time for you listening. Because this was not running on the massive cloud computing clusters we have today.
No, definitely not.
Lynette 5 was trained on a silicon graphics server with a single 200 megahertz processor. I mean, that is vastly weaker than the simplest modern smartphone.
To show the network the data set just 20 times took 2 to 3 grueling days of computation.
2 to 3 days. And if you made a single mistake in your setup, you lost half your week.
Exactly. So LeCun used his deep understanding of the error valley's curvature to survive that excruciatingly slow hardware. He used the curvature math from optimal brain damage to dynamically adjust the step size during training.
So he was squeezing every ounce of efficiency out of that weak processor.
He had to. And furthermore, the architecture of Linet 5 itself was heavily inspired by biological efficiency. Drawing from the structure of a cat's visual cortex, the lower layers of the network acted like simple biological cells.
Right, so they scoured the image for tiny basic features, short curves, edges, straight lines.
But as you move to the higher layers, the network did something incredibly clever. It deliberately blurred the exact locations of those features. It pooled the data together.
Why blur it?
Because if you memorize the exact pixel location of an edge, a slightly slanted or shifted letter will break the system. By blurring the location, the network becomes immune to messy handwriting.
Ah, so it only cares about the presence of the shape in a general area, not its rigid, perfect placement.
Right. And this architecture culminated in November 1998 with a massive 40-page paper published in the Proceedings of the IE titled Gradient-Based Learning Applied to Document Recognition.
It was essentially a declaration that the era of handcrafted human rules was dead. The machine was now fully capable of extracting its own features from raw pixels.
But
wait, I have to stop you there, because that 1998 paper is famous, but almost everyone only cites the first half, the part about Linet 5.
That is very true.
But LeCun himself has said the true breakthrough was in the back half of the paper, the part about graph transformer networks. The source describes this as end-to-end learning.
Yes, the ignored blueprint.
But evaluating every single possible cut in a handwritten word simultaneously sounds incredibly inefficient. Mm-hmm. In 1998, on a 200 megahertz processor, wouldn't mapping out every possible scenario completely fry the machine?
You would think so.
Why not just build a better step-by-step cutting tool before handing the letters to the reader?
Because building a step-by-step cutter was the industry standard, and it was a fatal trap. Think about the cascading nature of errors.
Okay.
If you use a strict pipeline, step one is cutting the messy cursive into individual letters, and step two is reading them. If step one makes a bad cut, say, slicing a cursive M so it looks like an R and an N, step two is guaranteed to fail.
Oh, I see. The whole process collapses from a single early mistake.
Exactly. And the reader never gets a chance to correct the cutter.
So how does the graph transformer network physically solve this without frying the processor?
Well, instead of committing to one set of cuts, the network creates a mathematical graph. It's like a vast crossroads of every possible way the ink could be sliced.
The crossroads.
Right. It doesn't actually run a full analysis on every cut. It just holds them as mathematical potentials. Then it evaluates all these possible segments simultaneously, layering grammar rules on top of the visual guesses.
So if the system is reading a bank account number, it knows the structural rules, like the required length.
Precisely. The grammar rules act as a filter for the visual noise. And because the entire system, the cutter, the reader, and the grammar filter was mathematically differentiable, they could use backpropagation across the entire pipeline.
And this is the magic of end-to-end learning.
Yes. When the final output is wrong, the mathematical error flows backward through the entire graph. It tells the reader to look closer, but it also reaches all the way back to the cutter and says, hey, change your slicing parameters. You set me up for failure.
The entire system learns as one unified entity. It continuously adjusts its own internal assembly line.
It was revolutionary. And that ignored blueprint, that exact end-to-end architecture from the back of the 1998 paper, didn't just sit gathering dust on an academic shelf.
No, it transitioned directly into the real world. It became the literal software loaded into those bank machines from the opening scene of our deep dive.
That blueprint became a reality through a partnership between Bell Labs and NCR, a company that built back-end settlement machines for banks. Together, they developed the HCAR50 system, which deployed in June of 1996.
And the scale it achieved is staggering. By 2001, systems from this lineage were processing roughly 20 million checks every single day.
That accounted for between 10 and 20% of all checks written in the United States.
But the secret to its massive commercial success wasn't just raw intelligence, was it?
Not at all. It was deeply, profoundly humble.
Humble. Explain that.
Well, actual checks from the real world are chaotic. They have printed background images of mountains, coffee stains, folded creases, and wildly overlapping handwriting.
Just a mess of visual noise.
Right. The Graph Transformer Network evaluated all this, but if the mathematical confidence score wasn't high enough, the machine simply gave up.
Humility was its greatest design feature. It didn't try to guess. It routed that messy check directly to a human clerk.
It took the boring, easy half of the pile and left the genuinely difficult half for the humans.
And because it knew exactly when to walk away, the error rate on the checks it did process was kept strictly under 1%. For a bank, an incorrect amount entered into a ledger is catastrophic. They could only trust the machine because of this built-in restraint.
This highlights a massive historical contradiction for you, the listener, to appreciate.
All the irony here is amazing.
Right. At the exact same time that HTAR50 was quietly processing millions of checks a day, academia was actively freezing AI funding. Researchers were scoffing at neural networks, calling them a complete dead end.
But the market, the banks whose entire existence relies on not losing a single cent, trusted these networks completely. The market was right when the academics were wrong.
It is a profound irony. And, you know, this wasn't even the first time LeCun's team proved the immense market value of neural networks. A few years prior, in 1993, we see another brilliant application of throwing information away.
Siamese networks.
Exactly. NCR had come to Bell Labs with a different problem. They wanted to automatically verify handwritten signatures on the back of credit cards to prevent fraud.
But the hardware constraint was brutal. The magnetic stripe on the back of a credit card in 1993 could only hold 80 bytes of data.
80 bytes?
I mean, 80 bytes is nothing. It is less than a single line of plain text. How do you possibly verify the sweeping, complex geometry of a human signature without actually knowing what it looks like? You can't store a picture in 80 bytes.
You solve it by entirely changing the objective. LeCun, along with Jane Bromley and Edward Seckinger, created twin neural networks, hence the name Siamese networks.
And twin networks.
These twins shared the exact same weights. Instead of asking the network to memorize the visual pixels of a signature, they taught it to map signatures into a mathematical space and evaluate the distance between them.
So imagine the network assigning a set of GPS coordinates to every signature.
That's a good way to visualize it.
When the twin networks see two genuine signatures from the same person, they calculate the error by saying, these belong together. The backpropagation adjusts the math to pull those two GPS pins closer together on the map.
Right. And if it sees a genuine signature and a forgery, it aggressively alters the math to throw that forgery's GPS pin to the opposite side of the map.
It acts exactly like a mathematical spring, pushing and pulling data representations. It didn't need to memorize the image at all.
It just learned the essential features needed to discriminate between same and different. It distilled a person's entire unique physical handwriting style down to a tiny 80-byte mathematical fingerprint.
Just like the optimal brain damage surgery, the network succeeded because it learned exactly what information to throw away.
And this concept of pushing and pulling data representations, mapping out the distance between features, is the exact foundation for how modern facial recognition systems on your phone work today. It all comes back to defining what is truly essential.
That philosophy of separating the essential from the noise was tested on an even grander scale as the 1990s progressed. Because as LeCun systems mastered the art of reading ink on paper, a new global infrastructure emerged.
The internet.
The internet. But the internet of the mid-1990s had a massive bottleneck. It was painfully, agonizingly slow.
The World Wide Web was great for transmitting plain text, but if you wanted to upload a scanned document, say, an ancient manuscript or a dense scientific paper, the file sizes were catastrophic.
The standard image compression of the time was JPEG, and JPEG has a fatal flaw when it comes to documents.
It really does. The underlying map of JPEG relies on frequencies, which works wonderfully for smooth gradients in a photograph of a sunset.
But when JPEG encounters the sharp, high-contrast edge of a text character, the math breaks down. It creates ringing artifacts, blurring the sharp edges.
Furthermore, JPEG treats the black text the exact same way it treats the subtle, low-contrast gradients of the yellowing paper behind it.
So if you tried to compress a document with JPEG, it either created massive files that took tens of minutes to load, or it blurred the text with ugly artifacts, making it completely unreadable.
Because remember, in computer memory, a crisp black and white pixel is just a one or a zero. It takes almost no space. but a color pixel requires complex 24-bit data for red, green, and blue values.
So LeCun, alongside Limbo 2 and others, pivoted to solve this. They created a compression format called GVU.
And they applied the exact same logic of restraint. DV separated a scanned document into three distinct layers.
Walk us through the layers.
First, a high-resolution, purely black and white layer, strictly for the crisp text. Because it's only one-bit data, it takes up virtually no space, keeping the edges perfectly sharp.
Right.
Second, a heavily downsampled, low-resolution color layer, just for the stained, textured background paper. A coffee stain doesn't need sharp edges, so you can throw away most of that heavy color data.
And finally, a third layer for any actual photographs or figures.
Exactly. By forcing all that heavy color data into a low resolution layer, they essentially tricked the computer into saving massive amounts of space.
Yeah.
A BGV file was roughly 1/10 the size of a comparable PDF or JPEG. A page that used to take 10 minutes to download over a dial-up modem would suddenly pop up on your screen in seconds.
It was a massive leap forward.
But, and I have to point this out, I am struggling to square this with everything else we've discussed. This is a man who spent his entire professional life arguing that machines must be allowed to learn their own rules from raw data.
Yes.
Why is he suddenly handcrafting geometry filters for DJV instead of using a neural network? Did he compromise his own core philosophy?
He compromised out of stark necessity. He had actually tried to use a neural network for image compression back in 1986 during his PhD.
Oh, he did?
Yes. He built an early version of an autoencoder. That's a network forced to squeeze an image down to a bottleneck and then recreate its own input, learning the essential features along the way.
But it didn't work.
Well, he learned a painful lesson. 1980s and 1990s computers were simply too slow to computationally redraw every single pixel of a high-resolution image on the fly. He used handcrafted geometry in DJVU because he had to.
It was an exercise in restraint. He knew he couldn't force a neural network solution when the hardware simply wasn't ready to support it.
Exactly. And the legacy of DJVU goes far beyond that technical compromise, though. It profoundly shaped LeCun's philosophy on how technology should be shared with the world.
Right, because LeCun and Botu used DJVU to scan and upload the entire archival history of the NIPS conference, which is the main gathering for neural network researchers.
They put thousands of pages of dense math on the early web entirely for free.
Because the format was incredibly lightweight and crucially free from corporate licensing lock-ins, it became a lifeline for the developing world.
Libraries in Poland, operating on impoverished, slow internet connections, adopted DJVU as their standard for digitizing centuries-old rare books and ancient texts.
It proved to LeCun that if you create a powerful tool for knowledge and leave it open source, it will naturally flow to the places that need it most. That belief that AI tools must remain open source and free rather than locked inside corporate walled gardens remains one of his defining battles to this very day.
Which perfectly ties together the core theme of this deep dive into the source material. Whether it was putting an artificial brain on an operating table and cutting away 75% of its connections, summarizing a complex signature down to a tiny 80-byte map of distances, or stripping the heavy color background noise away from a scanned page of text.
Success in the early days of artificial intelligence was fundamentally about knowing exactly what information to throw away.
This raises an important, perhaps unsettling question for you to consider as you look at the AI landscape today. We discussed how the HCAR50 check reading machine processed 20 million checks a day flawlessly because it was humble.
It evaluated the messy reality of human handwriting, and when its mathematical confidence wasn't high enough, it simply gave up and handed the task to a human.
It knew when to say, I don't know.
Now, look around at the artificial intelligence systems dominating the news today.
We're surrounded by large language models that, when faced with something they don't understand, confidently hallucinate false answers. They invent facts with absolute certainty rather than admitting a gap in their knowledge.
It's the exact opposite of humility.
Exactly. If the very foundation of successful commercial AI in 1996 was built on knowing when to give up, what does it mean for our future that today's machines seem to have completely forgotten how to say, I don't know?
That is a thought that should definitely linger with you the next time you ask an AI for an answer. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the source material. We'll see you next time.